in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Lincoln Square Mall in Urbana, with more than a dozen shops, businesses, and restaurants, including unique baby gifts with custom baby bedding and accessories, Enzo's Pizza, Brownfield Sports, Strickland Insurance, and Field of Greens.
Good morning and welcome back to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program for the morning. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing this program, Harriet Williamson, Travis Stansel, Jason Croft is at the controls. Tomorrow, in the first hour of the show, we will welcome back here our guy we sort of think of as our car mechanic, Rick Karch, from Rick's Automotive in Champaign. We try to have him on every season, so that means four times a year. And I guess this will be the summer show. If you're having car trouble, call in, tell us about it, and he'll do his best to help you figure out what the problem is. And then in the second part of the program, we'll be talking about PCBs and other environmental pollutants. And we'll have a couple of guests who have been here on the campus for a major conference, and people from all over the world here over the last couple of days talking about that problem, PCBs. And we will have two guests here on the show, Kerry Hornbuckle, Associate Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at University of Iowa, and then Aki Bergman, who's Professor of Environmental Chemistry at the University of Stockholm in Sweden. The two of them will be here tomorrow, and we'll see what we can do to cover the basics on that particular issue. Questions always welcome here on this program, any other, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And in this part of the show, we will be talking with Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He is a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana. He is here every other month for this general kind of program we call Talk to the Family Doctor. We thought a long time ago that it would be, you know, we try to do different specialists throughout the year, but that it would be a good idea on a regular basis to have a general kind of guy who many different people. He sees children, he sees grown-ups with a variety of complaints. And so the idea here is if you have some question, a concern for yourself, for a member of your family, you can call. I always say, here we go, with my disclaimer, I always say, keep in mind that, of course, it's difficult to do diagnosis over the phone. There are some limits on what we can do, but this might be a place to start. You can get some basic information, and then if you have concerns, you need, of course, to pursue that with your own doctor. But you can start here if you'd like to talk with Dr. Jeff. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, David. I'm glad to be back.
We appreciate it. We'll see what kind of calls we can get. We have a caller ask the question off the air, and I hope that there's enough information for you to talk, and then if that person wants to follow up, they certainly can. The question from the caller is wondering why a man would get recurring bladder infections when apparently there has been some treatments with antibiotics, and there is no prostate enlargement. Does that give you enough? Can you say something general about men and bladder infections? I guess my understanding was that men generally didn't, it wasn't that much of a problem in men. Not that it can't be a problem, but it's generally not.
It's not necessarily a common problem, though if you're suffering from it, it's obviously a problem at the time.
Sure.
The general term UTI gets bandied about quite a bit, both by the lay and professional staff, referring to urinary tract infection. It's not a very helpful term in the sense that the urinary tract extends from your kidneys down through your ureters into your bladder, down through the urethra, and you can get a type of infection in any of those areas. Symptoms may be a little different depending on where it's located. As such, bladder infections in men are relatively uncommon. And if it's recurrent, raises the question of, is there some type of physical obstruction to the flow of urine that's allowing essentially urine to stagnate in the bladder and become a breeding ground where bacteria can grow. In men, the most common reason for that would be something related to their prostate. Mm-hmm. The prostate sits at the base of the bladder, and as the prostate enlarges with age, it can indeed cause some physical obstruction to the outflow of urine from the bladder. But in somebody who doesn't have any prostate-related problems, you'd have to start thinking of some other type of anatomical obstruction. Occasionally, kidney stones will be a source for recurrent infection. There are some anatomical abnormalities in the plumbing. What's referred to as posterior urethral valves is a fairly rare cause for recurrent infection. But if truly a male is having recurrent bladder infections that have been documented to clear up after treatment with antibiotics, then this is an individual who probably needs to go see a urologist for further evaluation. That evaluation might include x-rays of the kidney and bladder and a procedure called cystoscopy, where a lighted instrument is placed up through the urethra into the bladder to look around and see is there something else going on inside of here that is predisposing to recurrent infection.
I would think that because they were soft tissue, can you take an x-ray of the kidneys and structures like that?
The x-rays of the kidney are typically done with intravenous dye.
Oh, okay.
Basically, you put some material into the veins, let it circulate. As the blood gets filtered by the kidneys, it concentrates the dye there, and then you can take essentially an x-ray and get a good view of the kidneys. And then as the urine drains from the kidney down to the bladder, you can simply follow the contrast, the dye, through the entire urinary tract.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I hope that helps. If the caller would like to follow up, he is welcome to do that. Otherwise, we do have some other folks, and the next person is in Chicago. This is line number 4. Hello.
Thank you. As a general rule, if a person a friend who was admitted to a hospital having a stroke and then subsequently admitted and placed under monitoring and observation the next day, would they, and having a heart valve problem, etc., would it be advisable or not for them to be eating a full meal, or would it be better to have possibly kept them on some kind of a intravenous maintenance? Would a full meal sort of be overloading their capacity to handle the meal and maybe impose upon a burden upon the whole process?
A lot would simply depend on the nature, the size and location of the stroke. There are some stroke sufferers who then have difficulty swallowing.
Well, they didn't have that problem, but apparently, okay. I guess a heavy meal would overburden the system and somewhat, as I understand, a lot of the blood going to the digestive system to digest the food. You know, I'm thinking of that sort of thing.
Generally, that's not a major concern. The primary reason for somebody to then not eat after, say, a stroke would be if they were anticipating doing any type of test or intervention that would involve sedation, general anesthesia, any kind of surgical procedure. As a general rule, you'd like the stomach to be empty so that, again, material from the stomach doesn't come back up and get aspirated into the lungs. That's the major concern.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. We'll go on to someone here locally. This will be a caller in Urbana on line 1. Hello.
Yes, I was referred to a specialist recently from a kidney scan of the right kidney. It was determined that the tube from the kidney to the bladder is enlarged unduly. And it was not explained to me why that would trigger a referral to a specialist. What is the danger?
It simply would be a matter of trying to answer the question of why that ureter on the right side would be enlarged. That would tend to suggest the possibility of an obstruction somewhere.
I see.
And the usual or perhaps the more definitive test is typically done by a urologist and is called a retrograde urethrogram. They basically would go in through the urethra into the bladder and then insert a small catheter into the base of the ureter, which is what connects the kidney to the bladder, and then put some dye and try to push that back up toward the kidney. And you can get a much better look at the ureter and what, if anything, might be in it with this particular type of x-ray as opposed to the scan that you originally had.
I see. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right. Thank you for the call. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana, and every other month he is here. It's always on a Monday, the 11 o'clock hour, for a general kind of talk to the family physician show. So if you have questions, you can give us a call, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that's 800-222-9455. We have another off-air question, and again, we'll do our best with it. People can probably help us if they'll ask the questions themselves, but especially if there's some follow-up that the doctor would like to do. But in any case, we'll try and do it this way. We have someone who has a question about inguinal hernia, and maybe you can talk a little bit about what that is, but specifically the person's question was, if they lose weight, will that help to resolve the problem?
The short answer is no.
All right.
The longer answer is the term hernia simply refers to an abnormal separation between two muscular layers, allowing the protrusion of some other tissue in between them. Normally, where two muscular layers come together, they are sort of joined much like a seam. And if that seam should separate, then whatever's on either side can theoretically then protrude through that opening. Mm-hmm. Now, the inguinal area is in the groin. And in men, there is a normal opening that allows some of the internal plumbing to get out to the scrotum and back and forth. So there's normally a small opening there that allows these structures to traverse that area. The most common hernia that men typically get is that this opening becomes progressively larger and can theoretically be enlarged by forceful lifting, where intra-abdominal pressure pushes down on this opening and causes it to separate even further. If it gets large enough, then a loop of intestine or bowel can slip down inside there. Mm-hmm. And many men will say, gee, you know, I tried to lift something and I noticed this bulge in my groin that started in the lower part of the abdomen and extended all the way down into the scrotum. And on physical examination, you can feel the protrusion of the intestine down through the opening. Now, as long as you can push everything back up inside, it's generally not much of a problem, though it is considered by many active men to be a significant inconvenience and often uncomfortable to have to put up with the hernia, so many men elect to have them surgically repaired. The only real danger that accompanies this type of hernia is if a piece of bowel gets pushed down through the opening and then get stuck there. What will happen is that it will become inflamed and swollen, and the swelling will cut off the blood supply to that portion of the intestine, and now that part of the bowel is going to die. Mm-hmm. That's going to hurt a lot. It's going to have the tendency to potentially rupture. That dead material in there is going to be a potential source of infection, and now your hernia is going to be repaired emergently, because this is a potentially very serious situation. Most hernias, though, as long as they can be reduced, by that we mean being simply pushed back, there's nothing urgent about their repair, and many men will simply choose to have them completed in terms of their repair on an elective basis at a time that's convenient for them. Mm-hmm. The only time that's really urgent is if something's actually stuck down there and you can't get it to go back.
Okay. And in terms of surgical repair, then it would be just doing something to close up that opening so that it would be enough so that whatever's got to go through there can go through there, but not big enough so that you get end up a part of a little piece of the bowel getting down in there, which is not supposed to happen.
That's correct. And in previous days, they simply took some of the surrounding tissues and pulled them up snug and literally sutured them together. In techniques currently used, especially for larger defects, actually a mesh-like, almost kind of like your screen door mesh, will be placed in there and sutured in place to serve as a physical barrier for other tissues getting past that point.
So does weight have something to do with that, with your tendency toward having that problem?
No.
No.
No. Okay. But the more physical pressure that you have pushing down from above, the more potential there is to cause the opening to separate a little further. But simply losing weight will not make that opening go away.
All right. Well, again, I hope that helps. Other questions are welcome. If you'd like to call in, talk with our guest, Dr. Jeff Swearingen, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Well, we are now not yet into July, which is on average the hottest month, but we still had some quite warm temperatures. And just, I know this is sort of a little thing, but it might be a good idea to just to remind people about how to, if you've got to be active, if you're going to be outside and in very hot temperatures like we've had, what kind of things should people keep in mind? In particular, I guess I'm wondering about when, what would be the indications that you might actually be into something like heat stroke?
Well, there are probably two major things about summer activities. One relates to, just as you described, overexposure to the heat, which is usually aggravated by dehydration. Mm-hmm. Basically, if people can keep their fluids up, they're much less likely to suffer things like heat stroke. The second part of kind of summertime activities relates to sun exposure, which obviously is part of the heat as well. But that gets us into the whole subject of sun exposure, skin damage, risk for skin cancers. There's a lot more emphasis on protecting the skin these days, simply because our knowledge is better about especially the damaging effects of early childhood sunburns on the later risk for skin cancers. And there's also a cumulative risk to sun exposure and skin cancer. So in the summer months, the two biggies are, you know, sun protection and adequate hydration.
Okay. Well, we've got some other folks to talk with. One of these three people's on cell phone, so I'll tell you what, I want to go there first. And this is line number two. Hello.
Hey, doctor.
Yes.
Good. A few years ago when I had kidney stone problems, they discovered I also had gallstones, some rather large ones. They said they shouldn't be a problem if they don't move, but they really never told me what I should be looking for in case they do move.
If a gallstone remains within the gallbladder and makes no attempt to exit the gallbladder, it generally isn't going to cause too much trouble. When a stone tries to exit the gallbladder, it generally ends up in a tube smaller than the size of the stone, and the stone gets stuck. This will produce pain, perhaps reminiscent of your kidney stone. It's a very sudden, severe pain that has a colicky. It comes and goes as the tube attempts to force the stone through there. In the gallbladder, this pain will typically occur in the right upper part of the abdomen and is unmistakable. So if you're having trouble with your gallbladder in terms of stones trying to get out of it, you're definitely going to know it.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right. Thank you. Let's go to next, Bloomington, Illinois, and that's our line number four. Hello.
Hello. I have a general question. It's kind of settling a debate between a friend of mine. He had told me that the sort of the half moons that you see on your cuticles, on your fingernails, are somewhat, he says the larger they are, it's more related to your general health in terms of nutrition and diet. And I kind of always thought it was just like a tale, but I didn't know if there was any actual medical validity to that.
I'm not aware of any particular medical implications to the size of the cuticle. There are indeed some nail abnormalities that are associated with specific types of diseases, but I'm not aware of any specific connection between the size of the cuticle and one's general health.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right, thank you. Next, we'll go to a caller here south of Decatur, line one. Hello.
Hello, good morning.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. It's a very interesting show, and thank you, doctor. I have a question. A couple of years ago, I had inflicted upon myself an inguinal hernia from overlifting and purchased a truss from a therapy or a medical supply house and wore that for approximately a year, and it did help reduce the hernia and it basically eliminated the pain, and I was wondering, and I'm getting along now without it, and I was wondering, is that a frequent thing that they heal themselves, and what is the chance of that opening up again? I try to be careful, but what is the chance of that happening again? I'll hang up and listen, and thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you. There's no particular percentage I can put on the likelihood of recurrent trouble. It is possible in a few instances that scar tissue may form at the site of the hernia and be enough to physically block the opening and prevent recurrence. But that's not a very solid kind of repair, certainly not as solid as a surgical repair. A truss is simply an external device worn to put some physical pressure over the opening to try and dissuade the part above from dropping into the area below. And for men who either aren't good surgical candidates or aren't interested in pursuing surgery for whatever reason, a truss can be a way of symptomatically reducing the discomfort associated with portions of the intestine going back and forth through that opening, and is a perfectly acceptable way of handling a hernia. It doesn't make the opening go away, and so there is still the possibility that, again, as he said, if he wasn't careful about lifting, he could exert enough physical pressure, push down on some of the abdominal contents, and force it back through that opening. But as long as he's getting along well, using the truss and being careful with his activities, that's perfectly acceptable.
Yeah, okay. So just it sounds as if sort of normal everyday activities is not likely to produce hernia, that this is something that really you got to have to work. Do you have to work at it to get that to happen?
It's actually thought that the tendency toward having a hernia might be something that's inherited. And that certain individuals may simply be born with either a slightly larger opening to begin with or one that's maybe just a little bit weaker, and that over time with particular physical activities where you're putting more and more strain against that opening, that it gradually gives, and at some point gives enough that it's open large enough that the intestinal contents can then protrude through it.
Okay. Well, we're about midpoint here in this part of Focus 580, talking with Dr. Jeff Swearingen. We have another caller we'll get to in just a second. I do just want to also remind everybody who's listening that there is, in effect, for our county here, Champaign County, and a lot of others in our severe weather coverage area, a severe thunderstorm watch. This is for parts of northern and east central Illinois, and that will be in effect until 1 o'clock this afternoon. There's possibility of hail, thunderstorm, winds of up to 80 miles an hour, and dangerous lightning. It's possible in these areas. And in our severe weather coverage area, these counties are included: Champaign, Ford, Vermilion, Douglas, Edgar, Coles, and Iroquois. And some of the surrounding ones, even though they're not in the severe weather coverage area, we know that there will be people listening. So just to mention them, also included Moultrie, Piatt, DeWitt, McLean, and Logan. So do keep in mind that this is a severe thunderstorm watch. That means conditions are favorable for severe storms in and close to the watch area. Keeping an eye on what's going on, and of course, we'll let you know if we have further watches or warnings. Again, a severe thunderstorm watch for parts of northern and east central Illinois until 1 this afternoon. And there has been some, a little earlier this morning, looked like some pretty good thunderstorms up not very far north of us in Livingston and Iroquois County. So there is that possibility until 1 o'clock. Our next comprehensive look at the weather will be as part of the afternoon magazine, and that will be at 12:35 this afternoon. Celeste Quinn is the host for the show. Here this morning in this part of Focus 580, we are talking with Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor from Carl Clinic, and every other month this year for the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. It's always on a Monday at 11 o'clock hour, and whatever's on your mind, you can give us a call, and I know he'll do his best to give you an answer. And we have a caller here ready to go in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I have a male relative who needs a catheter because of an enlarged prostate, and he is under medical care, but I just wondered what some of his options are because I have medical power of attorney. He is not voiding, and they've attempted to help him void now on several occasions, but it's just not working. He is taking Proscar to shrink the prostate.
Correct.
And he's taking another drug, I can't remember what it's called, is it called the urethra?
Correct.
Okay. And he's been doing this now since April 2nd, actually. And we have another appointment in early July and then another one in early August. And we're not, eager to run into surgery, but Can someone live with a catheter, for any period of time? It's sort of incapacitating for him, and he doesn't, his hands shake, so he can't really empty the bag himself, and that means he needs to be in a nursing home. He'd rather be back in his own apartment. What are some options? Does it take a very long time to have those two medications begin to work, the one that relaxes the urethra and the one that shrinks the
prostate.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes. So what kind of options are there for somebody who's in their late 70s?
Well, you mentioned surgery, and that's probably the most common physical intervention.
Mm-hmm.
That would obviously depend on his overall general medical health and fitness for the operation, which is not just the surgery, but also the general anesthesia that goes along with it.
Right. His health is quite good.
In that particular case, he may indeed be a candidate for a wide variety of surgical procedures mm-hmm. that could help prevent the prostate from obstructing the outflow of urine from the bladder.
Mm-hmm.
And those would be the sorts of things to discuss with the urologist at his next appointment. Now,
right.
You've mentioned a couple of the non-surgical treatments.
Mm-hmm.
Putting a catheter in, essentially fixes the problem because you can empty the bladder now.
Right.
But as you pointed out, is not a terribly attractive final solution.
Mm-hmm.
And
can it ever be a final solution if he strengthens his hands, which we're working on, to be able to empty the bladder, to empty the bag himself?
Yes, it can, but it's typically done in situations where people either haven't responded to their medications or are poor enough surgical candidates that they're rejected for surgery. So it's not considered the ideal solution. But yes, you can catheterize indefinitely, but there are risks to having a foreign object essentially in the body, and those basically relate to infection. There's a much higher risk of repeated urinary tract infection in somebody who's catheterized all the time. The medications you mentioned There are a couple of things. One, to help shrink the bladder, and the other type of medication is in a class of drugs referred to as alpha blockers. These have been in the past prescribed for high blood pressure, but were actually found to be much more useful in men to help, as you say, relax the opening that allows then the urine to flow past the prostate.
Mm-hmm.
Those take effect usually within a couple of weeks. In terms of shrinking the gland, that's obviously going to take a number of months. But both of these are worthwhile non-surgical mm-hmm. means of trying to handle this. The catheter, in the meantime, if necessary, is certainly something that can be carried on for, if need be, an indefinite period. But if he's otherwise in good medical mm-hmm. shape, pursuing some of the surgical options would be quite reasonable.
Can you tell me just generally what those options might be?
Well, the classic surgery is what's referred to as a TURP, transurethral resection of the prostate.
Mm-hmm.
People often refer to this as the Roto-Rooter procedure, because if you think about, you know, an obstructed plumbing line, you basically snake an instrument inside there and basically just kind of force your way past the obstruction by drilling through the material that's sort of stuck in the opening.
Mm-hmm.
In this particular case, the prostate is growing around the urethra at the base of the bladder, and the urologist will go in there and literally cut out that portion of the prostate that's physically obstructing against the urethra. And then that should hopefully allow better flow afterwards. Now, there are risks related to the anesthetic, risks related to, you know, bleeding at the time of surgery.
Mm-hmm.
You can be incontinent as a result of this type of surgical procedure in some instances.
Is that a pretty high risk?
No, but it's definitely known to be a risk of this type of surgery.
Is it reversible? Is that kind of incontinence reversible?
Generally not.
Uh-huh. Okay. And we had heard that sometimes not the whole of the gland was removed. Sometimes, like, part of it would be removed rather than that made it less likely for incontinence to come to occur.
Right. The more you remove, the higher the risk of incontinence.
I see. Okay. And that is one of the main reasons people don't want to do surgery.
Correct.
Should incontinence occur, does that mean the person would again have to have a catheter?
It depends on the extent of the incontinence. For some individuals, it's nothing more than just a little occasional leaking, and a pad or a Depends or some type of undergarment such as this is sometimes adequate. In other instances, much more rare, somebody just doesn't have any control at all, and yes, they would need a catheter.
And then that person would need a catheter.
Yes.
Oh, my. Okay. So the risk of incontinence increases the more you remove of the gland.
Correct.
If there's nobody else waiting on the line, why would that be? If you have a minute to answer that question.
Well, anatomically, you're removing more and more of the structures that form the basis for controlling the exit of urine from the bladder. And as you take, if you went to take the whole prostate, you'd also end up taking some of the nerves that help control that area as well.
I see. Okay, so the least that you remove, the better.
Right, but that also means that it's more likely to reoccur. And there are gentlemen who've had to have their prostates operated on more than one occasion. So you'd ideally like to only have to do it once.
Of course. Okay. And any good... this would be a urinary tract surgeon, not just a general surgeon, but a urologist.
Correct.
Okay. Well, you have been very helpful. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Right. Thanks for the call. Before we get too far away from it, I'd just like to mention, you remember that severe thunderstorm watch I told you about 10 minutes ago? It's been canceled. You don't have to worry about that anymore. But again, we'll have an update for you on the weather 12:35. So whatever's going on that time, we'll let you know. And in the meantime, questions are welcome here for our guest, Dr. Jeff Swearingen. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Let's talk a little bit more about prostate enlargement. I guess it's my understanding that all men, assuming they live long enough, will experience that. Some enlargement of the prostate.
That's generally true.
And that it is possible that some urinary symptoms will go along with that. And I guess there also is some research that says it's possible some sexual dysfunction might also be related to enlargement of the prostate. Or at least, you know, men who have enlarged prostates, sometimes they complain about sexual problems. So how do you at what point would you expect to start to see that? How do you determine indeed whether that's going on? That is, you know, we're talking about benign prostatic enlargement. And right. Then what do you do about that? You know, particularly for guys who are having some of these kind of urinary kind of symptoms that we've been talking about.
Commonly, men will complain, you know, I'm getting up two or three times at night to urinate. Even during the day, I find myself going a little bit more frequently, but the volume's less. The stream isn't as large. It's not as forceful. I have to stand there and wait. you know, there's a little dribbling at the end. You know, these are fairly common symptoms of what we refer to as BPH or benign prostatic hypertrophy or enlargement. And these are not uncommonly seen as individuals get older. In many instances, men simply say, oh, well, that's just part of life and I'm getting older. And to the extent that you can live with that, that's okay. It's not something that you have to do anything about. So we generally tell folks, when your symptoms are bad enough that you want to do something about it, we will talk to you about some of the medications, which we mentioned with that last lady's call, medications to help shrink the prostate, medications to help the opening function more normally, and surgical procedures to basically open up the partial blockage that occurs that results in some of these symptoms. And so people simply need to determine for themselves, you know, how bad are my symptoms and what am I willing to do about them? Mm-hmm. And again, these generally aren't anything particularly urgent. Now, somebody who says, I haven't urinated for the last 3 days, you know, and it's completely obstructed, that's going to be a big problem. They're going to get a catheter, and then something's going to have to be done about that. So short of complete obstruction, treating these is based on the individual's willingness to put up with the symptoms. Now, this assumes that, again, we're dealing with a benign situation. Prostate cancers can cause the prostate to enlarge. And consequently, there's some overlap between the symptomatology of benign enlargement and prostate cancer as well. A annual digital rectal examination to feel the consistency, size, and whether there's any nodularity to the prostate is definitely recommended by most medical organizations. The blood test, PSA, or prostate-specific antigen, is recommended by some organizations, not necessarily recommended by some other organizations, in terms of screening for prostate cancer. It's not an ideal screening test. It is definitely recommended in individuals who have increased risk for prostate cancer, essentially a family history of prostate cancer, and in individuals who basically want to have the test, as long as they're willing to understand that it's not an ideal test. And in fact, the majority of men who have an elevated PSA, it's elevated simply because their prostate is enlarged, not necessarily because they have prostate cancer. But you're going to then have to do a biopsy to figure that out. Mm-hmm. So the combination of digital rectal examination, PSA if appropriate, and symptoms will determine whether somebody needs a biopsy to rule out cancer, but will also help identify situations where men can decide, do I want medication for my symptoms? Do I want surgery for my symptoms? Do I want to just live with it?
Yeah. Is there anything that that a guy could do to slow down the if we're assuming that prostate enlargement is sort of natural thing and happens to everybody, is there anything that you can do to slow down that process at all?
Currently, there are some studies that are being undertaken to look at do certain types of vitamin supplementation make a difference. We don't have the answers to that yet. There has been a recent trial with a particular medication to help shrink the prostate to see if that led to fewer prostate cancers. There were kind of mixed results on the preliminary data there. There were indeed fewer prostate cancers, but the ones that occurred were more advanced. So nobody quite yet knows what to do with that piece of information. So your question is a good one. They're being investigated. The final answers aren't available yet.
Okay. Well, let's go back to the phones here. Next person in line is in Champaign. Line one. Hello.
Hello. I have a question about scoliosis and spinal fusion. My granddaughter has had the majority of her spine fused due to scoliosis, and the physician said something about perhaps she would experience pain in as she aged in her back. And I'm wondering if there's anything she can do over the course of her lifetime to minimize the possibility that she will have trouble later.
Good question. And I should probably defer it to Dr. Harms, who's going to be on the air, I think, a little later this
Wednesday.
Month.
I think Dr. Harms was her surgeon.
Yeah.
I'm the grandmother from San Francisco, so okay. I'm new to this information.
Well, Dr. Harms is an excellent spine surgeon, and in terms of advice above and beyond what he would give, I'm probably not in any position to comment. The single most important thing that somebody can do in general for their back is to remain active, walking, and to keep their weight down.
Okay.
Those would probably be the two biggest things that one could do to help prevent future back trouble. Regarding the specifics of the scoliosis and the spinal fusion, I'm just really not qualified to comment on.
Okay, can I get the exact time that Dr. Harms is going to be on, if it's known?
Yes, ma'am. He's going to be on this program on Wednesday morning of this week in the 11 o'clock hour. So it'll be this hour of the show.
Okay, I'll call back.
All right, well.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye.
Let's go on here to the next caller, and Jim's going to have words
he'll
for you,
for
I'm sure. Altamont, line four. Hello.
Yes, I have a couple questions. I used to take, cholesterol problems, and the doctor put me on Lipitor, and I could not take that. It made my joints hurt, ached all over, so he put me on Zocor, and I have taken that, we'll say, for a couple of years, and in a couple different times, I get so weak, my knees hurt, my legs hurt, my hips hurt, and whatever, and I lay off of it, we'll say, like, for a week or two, and it clears up, and I go back on it. It may not happen for another 6 months. Will I create any liver problems with that situation?
It's a good question. Two of the known potentially really noticeable side effects related to this class of drugs for lowering cholesterol are, just as you mentioned, the sort of diffuse muscular aching that some people get, and the other major concern is abnormal liver functions. They appear to be separate problems, and one doesn't necessarily indicate the other. So in your particular case, the fact that you occasionally have some muscular aches and pains doesn't necessarily mean that there's anything going wrong with your liver, but it is considered a fairly standard practice on a regular basis for people who are on these types of medications to check their liver function.
Okay, well, I've done that several times. I didn't know.
Well, it's usually done about every 6 months and should be monitored as long as you're on the medication. Now, if you have the muscular aches as well, your doctor can check some additional laboratory work related to some muscle enzymes to see if indeed there's a direct cause and effect relationship between your use of the medication and your symptoms. It's kind of unusual for you to have trouble, stop the medication for a week, and then resume taking it and not have any trouble for months at a time.
Okay, well, I didn't know. Okay, I got another question. I'm not on these medications, but I'm just curious. It's talking about prostate. What happens if a person takes, you know, like Cialis and Viagra and whatever, does that mess up your prostate?
No.
Okay, I didn't know. I'm just curious.
No, it doesn't.
Okay.
That's not a problem.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you for the call. And again, we have about 7 or 8 minutes left in this part of Focus. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor from Carl Clinic. And if you have general kind of healthcare questions, call us, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455.
The caller made reference to Cialis and Viagra, and the other medication is Levitra. They're all in the same chemical class. They have a very similar mechanism of action. They vary a little bit in duration of effect. But these medications have been quite helpful for men with erectile dysfunction for a variety of causes. But it's been my experience in the last few years that we've had more men sort of coming to the doctor asking about this, which actually has been a good opportunity to talk to them about the rest of their general medical concerns as well. So for men who, you know, say, oh, I only go to the doctor when I'm sick, this has actually turned out to be a real help for us to make contact with people who don't get regular medical care.
Okay. To Urbana, another caller here, line number one.
Yes, hello. I also have a question about Lipitor. I was recommended to go on it some months ago, and it immediately had good effect, but I really hate taking a pill every day and feeling like you have to do that the rest of your life. So I'm just wondering, is it possible, I don't understand well enough how it works, once those numbers are down and, you know, maybe you've also, and you increase with exercise and change the diet and this kind of thing, can you go off it? Or can you experiment with it and see if the numbers stay down or, you know, if they go up, then you start again, that kind of thing?
Your question is an excellent one. As a general rule, medication is recommended for individuals who, despite their best efforts at diet and exercise, have been unable to get their cholesterol down into a healthy range.
Mm-hmm.
So if we assume that you've already done all the right things in terms of your diet and your exercise, it's highly unlikely that you would be able to maintain those good numbers without your medication.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially, yes, you're going to be on it all the time. On the other hand, if you're taking medication and you say, well, I really haven't done my best job yet with diet and exercise, and you go ahead and add those other efforts, it would be perfectly reasonable at some point to back off on your medication and simply remeasure your numbers.
Oh, and how long would, like, what would be the, what's the word, the, how long would you wait until you checked again to see if it made a difference?
If you've been on your medication and you've made some lifestyle changes in terms of diet and exercise, it would be perfectly reasonable to stop your medication and then in, say, 3 months, simply check your numbers again. If they've gone right back up to where they were before, you basically are an individual who needs to stay on their medication in order to keep their numbers down. On the other hand, if you've made some significant changes in diet and exercise, and that's the predominant reason your cholesterol was up in the first place, then you may indeed be able to keep it down.
Okay, good. Thanks a lot.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay, bye.
Just real quick, again, since we were talking about prostate issues, there is an over-the-counter so-called natural herbal product, a thing called saw palmetto,
mm-hmm.
that is thought to have some benefit in terms of shrinking enlarged prostate.
Right.
Has that indeed been found to?
It's actually one of the few over-the-counter supplements that does have some clinical studies associated with it that have shown some potential benefit. There doesn't appear to be any real downside to giving it a try. So I personally don't have any objection to individuals who want to give that a try.
Okay. Well, I thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Dave.
And we will see you in August, I guess.
We'll be back.
All right. Dr. Jeff Swearingen, he's a family practice doctor from Carl Clinic in Urbana. He is here every other month, always on a Monday for this show that we call Talk to the Family Doctor. Our program is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates this year, celebrating their 22nd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. You may be aware of the outstanding support that we have received during our April and October pledge drives. We think that's an indication of the value that listeners place on WILL. However, we want you to keep in mind that our fund drives only raise about a third of our total listener support contributions. And as of today, we are a little over $131,000 short of our June 30th goal. To ensure the quality and the variety of our program schedule in the coming fiscal year, we hope that you will call 217-244-9455 now with your renewal or possibly to make an additional gift. Also, if you'd like to do it online, that's possible too. You can go to our website, point your browser to WILL.UIUC.edu and make a credit card contribution on our website. So again, WILL.UIUC.edu, that's the website. Or if you'd like to just give us a call and do it that way, the number is area code 217-244-9455. And again, reminder that tomorrow morning on the program, in hour number one, our guest will be Rick Karch from Rick's Automotive in Champaign. It's a car care kind of thing. If you're having a problem with the car, just call in, tell us about it, and he will suggest how you can go about solving it. Then in hour number two, we will talk about PCBs and perhaps also get into some other environmental pollutants. And we'll have two guests, Carrie Hornbuckle, Associate Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at University of Iowa, and also Aki Bergman, Professor of Environmental Chemistry at University of Stockholm in Sweden. There are a couple of people who are here on the campus for a big conference that's going on looking at PCBs. That's tomorrow. We're here weekday mornings 10 to noon, 10 different topics for you every week. Always welcome your questions. And now, hope you'll stay tuned because up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up today on the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk about cats. Our guest will be a feline behaviorist, Pam Johnson Bennett. She's the author of 6 books now about cats, including Think Like a Cat. And her latest book, Cat Versus Cat, is about keeping the peace when you have more than one cat. That book will be released next month. Pam Johnson Bennett, our guest this afternoon following the 1 o'clock news. Let's take a look now at what's happening on the Chicago Board of Trade. July wheat, 358.5, up 8. September, 368, up 6.5. July corn, 289, up 3.25. September, 292.75, up 3. December, 294.5, up 3.75. March corn, 299, that up 4. July beans, 884.5, 884 now, that up 30.